actually, that guest is somebody who you've probably heard of. His name is Mark Frauenfelder, who I'm probably butchering his name. You might know him from such websites as Boing Boing, or from things like being the editor-in-chief of Make. So, you know, in the geek culture community out here, you know, he's certainly, that's been a common website for me to visit. And since Make has come out, I know a lot of our listeners follow that pretty avidly and are into kind of the maker culture. And he has a book out now called Made by Hand, Searching for Meaning in a Throwaway World. It's not so much tied to electronics, but is talking about the kind of maker philosophy. And so, Mark Frauenfelder, welcome to Technology Bites.
Thanks a lot, Peter. I'm glad that I'm the guinea pig on this Skype conferencing call.
Well, said that one of the things you need to do is learn from making mistakes, and we figure we'll just make ours live on the air.
Happy to be part of it.
So I must say I loved the book. I enjoyed the heck out of reading it. The things that you took on in it were pretty widely varied. And you want to give sort of the background about what got you into kind of doing a lot more things by hand and doing them yourself?
Yeah, you bet. So, you know, I've always been interested in things like do-it-yourself media. I published a zine in the 80s. That was actually called Boing Boing, which was the precursor to the website. And, you know, I was in my own band and pressed my own records and stuff. But I wasn't really a do-it-yourselfer with physical things. But when I became the editor-in-chief of Make Magazine and I started hanging out with all these amazing contributors who, you know, make all sorts of really cool robots and rockets and things like that, I was really inspired by them because I realized that they were having a great time. They were, living with the stuff they made. And it seemed to be like a really rewarding and fulfilling way to operate. So I started, you know, an experiment to see if I could become more of a do-it-yourselfer myself. And so one of the things I thought would be fun to do would be to get more involved in getting closer to my food source. Because that's something, you know, you get a lot of bang for the buck because, you know, what I started doing was like raising chickens and keeping bees, old school food preservation methods like dehydrating and making my own yogurt and sauerkraut and kombucha and all those kinds of things. And, you know, I found that when you're that much closer to the food you eat, you start to develop more of an awareness and you're more observant of, you know, not only the things that you make that you eat, but everything that you eat. You start looking at the way things are prepared and cooked and pay more attention to vegetables, how things are grown. It's you know, becoming a do-it-yourselfer is a way to appreciate the world more than before. At least that's what happened to me.
Well, I liked that, you know, in the course of reading it, you know, I mentioned earlier, you talk about, you know, the making your mistakes and making plenty of them. That was, usually it seems like when you get these books and even Make, you know, you've got the guy who knows how to do it and he presents the plan that works. You know, nobody writes an article that says, yeah, I kind of halfway did it and then it fell over and caught on fire. Especially like the chickens, I liked, that was fascinating and very real and not sugar-coated. And it seems to me like either you get the people who are just afraid of doing something like that or else the ones who it's kind of, a mission for them. And so, you know, they're not going to tell you if there was anything that was disturbing or difficult about having chickens in their yard.
Yeah, you know, I didn't want to give people false expectations, and I wanted to just tell a true story. And I thought that, you know, including all the mistakes I made, and including, you know, the fact that all these makers that I know make tons of mistakes and have learned to not only live with mistakes, but have kind of worked them into their creative process, that's just a better way to go about it. You know, accepting mistakes, realizing that they can lead to better things, was something that I didn't realize before, and that was kind of an eye-opener to me and set me in a direction of kind of liberation about making things. And so by, you know, giving myself permission to make mistakes, I was able to feel more free to experiment and try things out. And thought, and, you know, my idea was, well, I'm probably going to screw this up, but if I get something out of it, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be okay. And that turned out to be the case most of the time.
Excellent. Well, you know, I guess, do you feel like did it make it something that was more desirable to you because of, you know, obviously you're highly involved in the kind of electronic world and spend, like the rest of us, a lot of time staring at a computer screen.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like that sort of pushed you towards wanting to do something where you get your hands dirty and work directly with kind of the real world, or?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think that a lot of us, people who have been, you know, sitting in front of computers since the World Wide Web captured our attention around 1993 or so, the web was, you know, when it first started, it was uncharted territory waiting to be colonized. And so all these creative geeks went onto it and, you know, turned the World Wide Web into the richest, most powerful form of media that the world has ever known. And it's still growing, but I think, you know, it's pretty well established now. And all these creative people who had been spending every waking hour, you know, drinking Red Bull and staying up all night doing stuff on the web, kind of suddenly looked around and saw the rest of the world as the ultimate hackable platform. And so they're, you know, now making things in the physical world. And it does feel good to get away from the computer and the desk and to really use your hands, you know, other than pushing keys and moving the mouse around, to use your hands to actually build things and carve wood or, you know, build a model. Those kinds of things, it's a really satisfying, fun way to spend your time. And it's something that feeling you get from making something by hand is something that feeling can't be captured any other way than by actually doing it.
Reality instead of virtual reality.
Exactly. What a concept.
Do you think that the internet age or the tech age that we entered into with the whole drive to develop and build the web as we know it today may have caused a dearth of creativity in the physical world, non-tech, that is? Or do you think...
Yeah, I think a little bit. But I also think that, you know, the web now has become the greatest source of information and inspiration for making things. You know, one thing that I'm really into now is making cigar box guitars. And so it's so, you know, I go online, type in cigar box guitars, and I'm hooked up with thousands of other people who make them and are happy to share information about, you know, where to get fret wire, where to put the best place to put the pickup, ways to attach the strings to the body, all that kind of stuff, you know. And before the web, it would have been much harder to get that kind of information. And now you just go online and there it is. And the other thing is, you know, the web is like it's like a giant surplus store that's been indexed for you, so that you just go to eBay or McMaster Car or any of these websites and just type in the part you need and you find it, you know. That's fantastic. And then there's all these rapid prototyping services where you can get your printed circuit boards made for you, or you can get 3D models made. So, you know, we're living in a golden age of making right now. It's really wonderful.
Mark, you know, I'm this is Dwight Silverman. I'm in my mid-50s, or getting there anyway. And I remember as a child, there was a whole culture of toys for kids who are like, say, starting about 10 and up, you know, erector sets,
101 electronic kits.
Right, 101 electronic kits.
The robot that would mangle your hands.
Right, the robot that would mangle your hands. And every kid, or at least every boy I knew, had these. And it seems that you know, the generation I was in was kind of raised kind of to do these kind of things with your hands. now I've got kids of my own. They're now in college, and they were coming up and they were younger, I saw very little of this for them, either for boys or girls, because, you know, you didn't have to have 101 electronic kits. You just got, you know, a handheld electronic device. Do you think that there's a generational thing that's happening here? Or do you see a problem with kids not being exposed to this kind of thing early on?
Yeah, I definitely do. I think that, you know, shop classes have been disappearing and are continuing to disappear from high schools for a number of reasons. You know, one thing, a shop class requires a smart, skilled instructor to oversee, you know, 12 students at most. If they're going to be operating power machinery, you can't have that many students in a classroom. So there's liability issues and the expense issues. You know, it's much easier to shove 50 kids into a classroom and pair them up on computers keep them occupied that way. But I don't think that's... You're not teaching people... you're not teaching young people as well as you can. The way that kids are being taught now, they're being taught to be scholars. You know, they're taught to stare at their desk. They're taught to access information. They're taught to write reports, which is great if you want to become, you know, a professor one day. But for all the other kinds of jobs, you really do need to learn, you know, hand-eye coordination, being able to think with your hands, being able, you know, trial and error, and actually interacting with the physical world. When you look at kids before they get into school, if you have young children like I do, whenever they see me with a tool, the first thing they say is, can I try that? I want to try that. And, you know, unless they're going to cut their head off by mistake, I'll let them try it, because that's the only way that they're going to learn. You know, even babies and infants learn by, you know, picking up something and dropping it and see what happens to it. You learn about the physical world when you use your hands like that. And I think it's a crime that schools are not focusing, you know, much more on project-based learning, where it's like, you know, we're going to build a kite today. And by building a kite, you learn geometry, you learn about the weather, you learn about physics. Then, you know, if you write about the report, the documentation for it, you learn English. All that to me is the way to learn.
Well, it seems like the funny part is and especially, you know, in the book, I was struck by kind of how organic all the things are, and in reading it, how separated most of our regular lives are from that. You know, the particularly the chapter on fermentation, where you're making sauerkraut at home and doing the one that's with the mushroom.
The kombucha.
Kombucha, which was just kind of I as I read it that and look at it, it's like I don't know if I could drink it. I don't know if I could.
You know, I think that's the way that. I mean, again, like we got chickens, and when my kids would bring their friends over and show them the chickens and pull the eggs out of the nesting box, the kids were amazed that we actually had, you know, chickens that laid eggs, and they said, "Are they edible?" And well, yeah, of course they are. And the kids would like take the eggs home with them and dress them up in clothes and put them in little houses, but they wouldn't eat them because they just thought, you know. I get my eggs from the grocery store. That's where food comes from. Food doesn't come from animals. And, you know, the same with sauerkraut is like the easiest thing in the world to make. It's just chopped up cabbage and salt. There's nothing else. Chopped up cabbage and salt, that's it. And then thyme, you know, just waiting a little while, a week for it to process. But, you know, people are afraid of it.
Uh-oh.
Like, oh, is it safe? Am I going to get sick from it? We become removed from a way of life that humans have spent, you know, the last 99.9% of our time on the planet is hominids. We've been making all of our own stuff, and it's only, you know, this tiny little droplet of time in recent years that we have become more dependent on buying everything that we need.
What do you say?
Do you feel like we're putting ourselves at risk with that, or, you know, how should we? How do you think we should get better balance in that for people so that it's not quite so, I guess, sterilized alive?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, just getting started in taking a little bit of control over, you know, the production of the things that keep you alive and well goes a long way, and it gives you more self-confidence. You know, just growing a garden yourself. You know, a lot of kids are surprised that carrots don't grow orange end up. And just to show them that the you know, the orange part of the carrot is in the ground is a revelation to a lot of kids. So I think, you know, doing your own gardening, simple things like making your own food and preserving your own food, those are things that have a payoff. They're fun. The process is fun. They're open to all sorts of experimentation. Then the end result is something that you can really enjoy. And, you know, I'm not against modern society or being able to buy things. I think, you know, the markets and mass production makes things affordable. And, you know, there are excellent mass-produced products and all that. But, you know, we don't have to lose the satisfaction and fulfillment that we get from making things on our own. Also, it's not all one or the other. There can be a mixture, a blend that's like a path that makes sense for you. And you know, you have to find your own way to fulfillment. And I you know, my book is kind of my exploration of how far I wanted to go one direction or the other.
Barrett.
Yeah, early on in our history, you kind of touched on this before, we were obviously a nation of makers, and you said that's been recently lost. Do you specifically know when we lost that? I mean, was that with the baby boomers? Was that before? Was that after?
Well, in the book, I looked at it a little bit, and my theory is that it might have started with this fellow named Edward Bernays. He was Sigmund Freud's nephew, and he was a master of propaganda. He was one of the first, kind of the inventor of public relations and modern advertising. Before Bernays was around, advertising was more about addressing people's needs. You know, do you need a car instead of a horse-drawn wagon? Do you need a bigger motor in your sawmill? Bernays was started addressing people's subconscious urges. You will feel better if you have a car. You know, people will better wear.
Unfortunately, you're breaking up.
I'm breaking up here.
Sorry, yeah, I was breaking up just a little bit, but
sorry about that.
No, it's probably our fault. retouch.
So Bernays was, you know, his goal was to create advertising to address people's subconscious urges. And so his big client was the tobacco companies and cigarettes. And he got, you know, his claim to fame was convincing American women to start smoking by saying that cigarettes were torches of freedom that would, you know, make them equal to men. And so by, you know, this kind of propaganda was very effective in getting people to start, you know, to making people ashamed of homemade stuff. And so I think around that time, you know, combined with, you know, a more efficient industrial processing capabilities, do-it-yourself kind of fell by the wayside. People were makers by necessity before that, and then it became, you know, people were just makers by choice after that. And so that's, you know, pretty much in the Western world, people are only makers by choice. You know, most of them are. But, you know, there's a small group of people out there who enjoy making things, and that's, you know, the readers of Make and all sorts of special interest groups and hobbyists and enthusiasts of all kinds who still, you know, make steam power motorcycles or, you know, make their own beer and all that kind of stuff. And I think that they recognize that there's something that's, you know, we're hardwired to want to make things, and they're, you know, scratching that itch.
Well, so what do you think will be, what's your next big interest along these lines? Are you going to build yourself a house someday, or Is that too far? Or?
I sure would like to build a cabin or something one day. I think that would be a lot of fun. The two things I'm working on now are working on different kinds of amplifiers for my cigar box guitars. I've been making amplifiers built in cigar boxes, and that's been a whole lot of fun. And then the other thing that I'm starting to work on is making an orchard on my property, because I think fruit trees are a really, you know, cool way. Once they're established, they don't take that much work, and you know, a well-maintained tree can produce an awful lot of fruit. So again, it's my search for, you know, bang for the buck.
Mark, you mentioned amplifiers for your cigar box guitars. I presume you've seen It Might Get Loud.
No, is that a documentary about cigar box guitars?
No, it's a movie about getting Jack White, Jimmy Page, and The Edge from U2 together, and there's a scene in it in which he assembles an electric guitar with a 2x4
Coke bottle, a pickup, and some electric wire.
It's worth seeing.
I saw the trailer. He was making a diddly bow.
Is that what that's called, the diddly bow?
Yeah.
Well, here in Houston, go ahead.
If you go online, there's a great website called onestringwilly.com. And the guy's like by day he's a chemist at a pharmaceutical company, and then by night he's kind of this, his alter ego is this guy who wears a black stocking cap and sunglasses and plays a diddly bow, which was an early instrument that was made in the South, and people who got good at the diddly bow, that one string instrument, would move on to cigar box guitars, and then if they showed promise there, then they'd get a real guitar.
Well, here in Houston,
I did see that bit. It's really cool in that movie.
Here in Houston, we boast one of the best cigar box guitar players that I've ever seen, who plays in a local band here called the Sideshow Tramps, Jeffrey Mueller. And he actually has a handmade cigar box guitar that he plays at shows live. And it's fascinating to see this thing go and see
somebody play it
very, very well. And this whole kind of, I guess, with the maker movement kind of getting back to our roots, getting back to this kind of the folklore of what makes us, you know, a civilization, this underpinnings of where we, you know, coming from the Industrial Revolution especially, and how we started to manufacture things. But before that, you couldn't get mass-produced anything. It seems to be, like when you were talking about the ad campaign for how things that were made or manufactured were better than things that you could make yourself, that kind of stigma is still with us. People would rather have a shiny iPhone than have something handmade or created for them specifically, or a one of a kind. So that's, you know, I don't think we really saw a change from, like Dwight was mentioning his age, and I'm not far from that, but when
neither am I. We're all in the same neighborhood.
When the when computers first started being available, you had to make them. You had to build them.
Yeah.
You had to have an understanding of the underlying technology to be able to put one of these together and have it work, and with nothing really to compare it to. And now we're driven more towards things like the iPad and the iPhone, which are just their application.
That's the antithesis of do-it-yourself as
right.
The iPad.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I feel sorry for my own kids about was when I had, you know, early MS-DOS machines and my Apple IIe, was that they all came with a basic interpreter in them. And, you know, you could go to the library and check out programs on, you know, typing in basic programs to see what the computer was doing. And you were, like, really getting under the hood. It was so much fun. And there's not really that much of that anymore, that kind of recreational computing like that. And I really miss that.
Yeah, kind of like with recreational car enthusiasts, where you could actually work. These days, you can't even work on your own car if you wanted to. The technology is so far advanced that the ability to actually pop open your hood and affect a change on the mechanics of your automobile is just not the way it was, even, you know, recently as the late 70s. But now you see.
Yeah, you open up the hood, and there's like another hood under it.
All right. Well, I'm going to give the last bit to Pete, and we'll see about closing this out, but appreciate your time.
Well, yeah, I definitely, you know, for those who are listening, this book is really good if you've thought about, if you've had some interest in kind of doing stuff yourself. It's not a, oh, here's how you should do it yourself. It's more of by watching somebody else go through some of these things, it makes it a lot easier to understand it for going through it yourself. So I would say if you're interested in becoming a maker and you aren't one now, it's a good book for that, or to give to somebody who maybe needs that little push to maybe think a little outside the box and all that. You know, thanks for
Barrett
thanks
has for one more
actually, quick somewhat harassing question, and you might not be the right person for this, but we had a Maker Faire in Austin in 2009 and we had nothing in Texas in 2010, and if there's anything we could do to get one in 2011, we've got a lot of makers that would love to have something back in Texas. So
and just in Houston out.
And in Houston. I'll drive to Austin, but I would love to have it in Houston.
We'd love to get back out there, and you know, we're looking at all of our options, and if we can, you know, any way that we can do it, we will do it.
Well, you'll get lots of radio promo from us.
That sounds good.
All right, Pete, go ahead.
All right. Well, you know, thank you for coming on, and like you said, the book is Made by Hand: Searching for Meaning in a Throwaway World, and I definitely, as somebody who's read it, I heartily recommend it.
Well, Peter and Dwight, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Well, that was a pretty awesome interview. I enjoyed that quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So, yay. I'll have to isolate that audio for just a standalone interview like we did with the guy from the CIA that we had a while back.
The cool side of that, too, is you don't have to be extremely techy to be a maker, too. I mean, you can go low-tech and you can do some things that would, you know, almost be considered like anachronisms going back and you're reinventing some of the early technologies, like, you know, renewable food and things like that.
Yeah, my dad has a subscription to Make magazine. He loves it. So.
Yeah, it's really neat. Most of that stuff is out there. I think it's just make.com, I believe.
Right. Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah.